Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is actually Alan here, who's I'll be on for a few minutes while Jackie has to attend to a few vital things. And I think tonight we'll be talking about some of the meanings behind Revelations. This is contained in the third book I put out there, which deals with a lot of the history of banking, religion, which have always gone hand in hand in every age. And I go through the meanings of Revelations and explain it as it really is, which is basically astral theology, as they call it, which again is simply the study of the stars, the times of the risings and settings of major stars, and the planets, of course. And you'll find that the zodiac is very important in all of this, because it's the heavenly plan, and that's the term they use, which is also the term that George Bruce Sr. used discussing everything going the way of the divine plan or the heavenly plan. That's when he gave his first New World Order speech. And you'll find it's more of a timetable written in the sky, and it was written many, many thousands of years ago, and possibly even millions of years ago, because the further we dig into history, we find that humanity was as we are today. That is not ape men, but humanity definitely existed much further back than the Darwinists have told us. In fact, Darwin, I think, was pulled out of the hat to try and cover up the fact that knowledge is not being discovered. Knowledge is being rediscovered, and science is being rediscovered, and very possibly it's being reused, and it's coming from archives. That's why research is called research. Why isn't it simply called search? There's very little today that we know of which wasn't discussed many, many thousands of years ago, especially by the Greek philosophers. We find they have the atomist school, as they called it, where they knew that nothing was really solid, and that tiny particles of matter revolved around each other, and were expected to believe that they simply came to these conclusions by their vast intellectual superiority, a bunch of nobility with nothing else to do but sit and think about things. Well, I don't care how long you would think about something, if you don't have access to a high-tech civilization with high-tech equipment, you could never come to that conclusion in a million years. So this knowledge was known a long, long time ago. And if we jump from there to the New Atlantis by Francis Bacon, who wrote the book in the late 1500s,
Alan.
And it was published in 1602.
Alan.
Hello.
I'm here, and I want you to just continue what you're saying, okay?
Yes, uh-huh.
And thank you very much for...
Yeah, it's a pleasure, yeah.
Uh-huh. So you were talking about the New Atlantis?
Yes,
published.
And the New Atlantis is the same thing.
Published in?
1602.
Right, you go ahead now.
And we find that he talks about a land to the west, which would be risen up to be a world leader. And of course, he's talking about America. And he said that it would have a form of government on the surface, he said, for the people, where they would think they had a say in matters, but in reality, there would be an invisible government of an elite bunch of intellectuals and scientists who would make all the decisions. He called it Solomon's land, and meaning the brotherhood. That's what he really was referring to, was the Masonic brotherhood, or in his day, Rosicrucianism. And he said that they had laboratories under the ground and within mountains where they did scientific testing on different things, and that all of these laboratories were powered by an energy which gave off the heat and light of the sun. Well, that's what we have today with nuclear energy. He then went on to say that in some of the laboratories, they could take the tiniest particles of matter, living matter, animal or vegetable, mix them together and create new types of species, and know exactly the type that they wanted at the end, before they even started, which tells you they'd done it before. He also talked about a machine which could manipulate the weather. It could cause rainstorms or droughts. It could create hurricanes or tornadoes and be guided to their target. And now this book, The New Atlantis, was a common book in universities for the last couple of hundred years or more. And we're expected to think that a man who lived in an age where the candle was the best form of light they had.
Yeah, 400 years ago.
Yep. And the horse and cart were the most were the best form of land transport. We were expected to believe that this man dreamed all this up by himself and wrote this tremendous book, which was also a prediction. As I say, America is the new Atlantis. And we know today that we are basically running towards a plan. We're part of a definite plan to spread, if you like, Solomon's word across the world, or make one system across the world. That's what it really means. And the United States is leading the charge. And up until now, it's been financing most of it through the taxpayer.
Did you say that there was not evidence that Solomon's temple was ever built?
Oh, that's right. I mean, even amongst the rabbis, there's debates as to where it was, because if there ever was one, they think it was much further to the north and not on the present site where Herod's temple was built. We know that Herod definitely built a temple.
Or he started building one.
He built it, but then the Romans destroyed it. It didn't last terribly long.
So it wasn't Solomon's temple that was destroyed?
Probably not.
It was Herod's temple.
The whole thing about the esoteric meaning of Solomon's temple is the temple is the individual high mason. It's yourself, in other words. You're rebuilding yourself. That's what Solomon's temple really means.
Mm-hmm.
And in the third book, I go through this, what the real meanings are, as opposed to what we've been taught to believe, which is mainly fictitious characters, or else, as I say, solar and stellar theology wrapped around stories concerning people. It's very cleverly done, because if you're indoctrinated at such a young age to believe these poor people are wandering through the desert and we have their names and all this stuff, we it doesn't recur to us that these are all stories of the planets and stars and the sun going through the zodiac.
And even Revelations,
uh-huh,
from what I was reading, and I did have to put it down, but that's what I was getting out of it as you were explaining,
mm-hmm,
that, for example, the lion with the 10 horns.
Yes.
And they depict him as 3 different animals.
Yeah.
And you said that it's the way they have depicted the, mm-hmm, the animals that are representing the different zodiacal signs.
That's right.
From one merging into the other, like spring into summer.
Yes.
Those animals are, and that's what that lion and the ten horns, what did that mean?
It's the same thing. The old zodiac, the very, very old one, only had 10 main symbols. And so they stuck to that, even though they updated it and added another two.
It was 10 crowns, wasn't it?
Yeah. In fact, today that they're even thinking of updating it to 14, because there are two more main constellations which have crept in there over the last few thousand years.
What does the word Sephiroth mean?
The Sephiroth?
Yeah.
It means emanations.
Oh, okay.
Emanations. They talk about the 10 emanations from the deity.
Okay.
And people study this all their lives often and never really catch on to what they're talking about. Everything that's put out there for people to follow is a maze of storytelling which captures the imagination, and yet very few people see through what it really means and finds the original meanings. And when they do, they kind of kick themselves, because some people have spent their entire life studying this stuff. You know, only to find out it's so simple, really.
How do you know what all this means, Alan?
How do I know?
Yeah.
I always knew. I could see through things from a very early age, and I can remember even going to Sunday school and hearing the stories, and then it struck me, because I also studied astronomy from a very early age. And before I went to school, and so I thought, my God, that's got an awful lot of common with, for instance, if you chart the planet Venus, if you chart it over the course of a year with its risings, its settings, and so on, you'll find it forms the six-pointed star. You know,
it actually does.
So
it makes the shape in
mm-hmm.
its movements. It makes the shape of the
yep.
six-pointed star.
Uh-huh.
And is that where that symbol came from then?
Yeah, that's why they chose that as one of their main... And they didn't choose it, really. It was there long before there was any Hebrews.
Oh, yeah, right.
You know? I mean, we're
just
going
like
back
the cross.
Into amazing timelines here. Long... I mean, even in the days of Sumer, they had these same symbols. And in the days of Sumer, they already had the stellar charts marked out so accurately that they could predict major changes and eclipses 5000 BC.
And wasn't there a particular planet, maybe in, was it the Pleiades, that the astronomers could not see even with
mm-hmm.
their huge telescopes,
yeah.
and yet they knew that there were seven when only six were visible?
Actually, there was eight at one time, because the ancient Greeks talked about one of them blinking out.
Oh, okay.
In other words, it went nova. You know.
And they knew that.
Yeah.
And yet, modern-day astronomers, it took them a long time.
Well, this is an amazing thing. When you go back into ancient Greece, they knew the world was round, and they wrote about it. And yet, after the Catholic Church was created, suddenly we're flat again. We're
wow.
a flat Earth for another few hundred years. So they go back and forth, giving us our realities, and it's so easy to do when you're all powerful and you're dealing with mainly an illiterate population. But as I say, the ancient Greeks had so much of this charted, and they got it from the Egyptians, who already had all that knowledge, but they knew the world was round, yeah. In fact, one of the ancient Egyptians calculated by using obelisks as sundials and watching the shadows and measuring them and having lines of them across Egypt. He actually calculated the diameter of the earth within a couple of percent, well, 1% of accuracy.
Who was that?
It was an ancient, he had a Greek name, but he
okay.
lived in Egypt. It was,
uh-huh.
And that was about 2,500 B.C.
Did you say today is Wednesday?
Yes.
Oh, the 29th. I have
yes.
a very short spiritual message here
mm-hmm.
that I would like to say. This is from A Course in Miracles,
mm-hmm.
and it really kind of reminds me of now. Delay does not matter in eternity. but it is tragic in time.
Mm-hmm.
And delay, I think about staying in the lie and the time, a quote, that is lost.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that makes... delay does not matter in eternity, but it is tragic in time.
Yeah. Yeah.
You had mentioned here in the book, this is on page 61,
uh-huh.
When you were first getting into Revelations,
uh-huh.
that the writers of Revelations borrowed heavily from the Zend Avesta,
yeah.
the Jewish codes,
mm-hmm.
Philo, and the Gnostics.
Yeah.
Who was Philo?
There's another historian, philosopher, that existed around that period. That there's nothing original at all in the Old Testament. In fact, it was all borrowed, which tells me that the people who formulated it, and we've got to start at the beginning with the Old Testament. The Old Testament was first put together, we are told, and all the rabbis agree about this, either 300 BC, and some say 100 BC, but they all agree that it was put together in Egypt by priests living in Egypt, and they didn't write it in Hebrew or Aramaic. They wrote it in Coptic Greek. So here we have a very high, probably Illuminati of their day, who had the knowledge of Egypt and Greece and who knows how many other cultures, putting together the Old Testament, what's known as the Septuagint.
Oh, the Old Testament.
Uh-huh. Putting that together in Egypt, writing it in Greek, for supposedly an Aramaic-speaking people living in Israel. So you have this ludicrous situation, but the rabbis all agree that's how it was done. And nothing survives, if there was any truth to any of it, nothing survives prior to that time. And so it was created in Egypt, given to the Jewish people. And even in the times of Jesus, they were still using that version in the synagogues. They preferred that version. And it wasn't until about 100, within 100 AD, that someone eventually tried to put together the first Aramaic or Hebrew version for the people. So yeah, whoever put this together had knowledge of different civilizations, the different sciences of those civilizations, and the histories of those civilizations, and made up a fictitious history.
Well, for example, Moses. It is said that the story of Moses
mm-hmm.
is an exact duplicate of the story of Sargon the Elder,
yes,
even of being put in the rushes, in the water, and being found as an infant.
Yes, and even to the flood. I mean, we know that the Sumerians had the Epic of Gilgamesh, and that was the first story form of any kind of flood, and the ones who survived it. So everything was borrowed from other previous civilizations.
And when did you say that they first wrote, put the New Testament in writing? I mean, the old?
They debated the argument amongst themselves, but around 300 BC, or even as close as to within 100 BC. And we've got to understand that at that period, the place that we call Israel today was a hodgepodge of immigrants from civilizations that had moved out of their own countries because of warfare.
You know why people believe it, though?
Uh-huh.
Because the gentleman that I talked to this week,
yeah.
he mentioned the different times that Jesus was allegedly had talked about Moses and the
mm-hmm.
prophets and
yeah.
et cetera, et cetera. And so that it had to be real, see?
Well, if that's good enough for him, that's fine, you know. But I think for many, many people, it's not good enough.
Well, the way it appeared to me
mm-hmm.
is that they put those words in his mouth so
mm-hmm.
they could tie the old with the new.
Well, there's no doubt that they kept updating the New Testament too. And here you have a situation in the New Testament where somebody came out, spoke against the Pharisees. Now, the Pharisees were one small sect in that area.
But very powerful.
Very powerful, but there were one. In fact, they were the Illuminati of their day. They were called Illuminati as well.
Okay.
They were a brotherhood, very secretive, who actually, and there's writings out there that many Jews know of, where the Pharisees themselves looked upon the common Jew no differently from anyone else. They were the bottom of the heap, you know. So they were one small sect amongst many sects, and of course they appeared out of Babylon. That's when they first came into being, is from Babylon. So there's speculation as to, was this mystery Babylon simply moving out and moving elsewhere? You see?
Yeah.
And that's the key to mystery Babylon. Mystery Babylon is wherever they go with the money, with the system, the trading, the banking, the usury, owning the sciences of every era, because they own the money supply of every era. And that's basically the mystery Babylon was a mystery because it was in one place and many places at the same time.
And you said that the frequent reference to seven in Revelations
mm-hmm.
is to the then known seven planets.
That's
including
right, yeah.
The
in
moon.
Fact, those were the degrees of what today they would call Freemasonry. Those were the seven degrees that the Greeks nobility went through, that the Egyptian nobility went through, and every other Aramaic-speaking peoples went through. That was a standard international brotherhood of its time, and those were the seven degrees, yeah.
And the Magi kept temples?
Yeah, and the same with Jacob's seven steps on the ladder going up to God. That was the 7 degrees.
Uh-huh.
That's why it's in every Masonic lodge, that picture.
Uh-huh.
You know. So we're talking about an inner brotherhood.
And it's all just about the planets and the situation of the planets and stuff?
That's the basis of it all. And, of course, it also refers to the... as I say, as above, so below. So they wrote a system of government where they could rule the world into the stars.
I don't understand. I don't understand that.
It's in the book, actually. The whole thing's in the book.
Okay, so I haven't got it.
And I even put diagrams in there where you'll see the upturned triangle resting on the apex of the other triangle.
Okay.
And I put the earth plane and the heaven plane. And so as it comes down, as the heavens comes to the earth plane, the sun becomes the sun king on earth. And the helpers of the heavenly host end up as the bureaucrats, lawyers, and so
and
on.
And that's what they mean as above, so below.
That's one of the main, that was the original meaning.
Wow.
So the whole thing was a system of how a few could dominate the majority.
Well, you know, see, and I'm only about 3 pages in.
Mm-hmm.
To the section on Revelations.
Yeah.
And that's what I wanted to get to, but
mm-hmm.
I was afraid I would miss something if
yeah.
I went right back to Revelations.
Mm-hmm.
And I could see, I mean, I've made some highlights, and but I can see that I could go back and read this again
mm-hmm.
and read it again, and each time I read it, understand something
yeah.
that I didn't understand the first time I was reading it.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's already happened.
Yes, sir.
I read a couple pages over
mm-hmm.
In the morning because I was reading it at night and I was sleepy, and so I picked up and I went right back and read those, and I caught so much more.
Yeah. Well, actually, I write things in a way which has the meanings contained within meanings, so each time you do read it, you will see another layer.
Uh-huh.
There's a technique to that, because the standard technique of teaching and conditioning we've all gone through with standardized education doesn't make your mind participate in your downloading.
Right.
You simply get downloaded and you repeat that download for examination.
Yes,
and then you forget it all.
Exactly.
You know?
That was just what I was thinking.
Yeah.
It would be like reading this
mm-hmm.
and being given a test.
Yeah.
And as long as I answered the question according to what was written, I would get an A and I wouldn't even understand what I had read.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
That's right. You know,
uh-huh.
And that goes for even many professions. That's exactly the technique. They don't have to understand it. They just have to be able to parrot it back, you see. And then they forget it. But so when you can write in a certain style where the persons, you understand where they are in their headspace because of their conditioning, you can actually help deprogram that person as they actually work through
wow.
the book.
Wow. But then it would be good recommendation
mm-hmm.
that this book be read more than one time.
Definitely.
Well, all of the three of them, but mm-hmm. this particular one is the one I'm into now.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But as I say, we've always been run in this planet, at least since the beginning of money and priesthoods that go hand in hand, and usury, which is the system of keeping control over a people. You start to control people by introducing your money and then your goods and then giving loans out. Once you have loans with interest, then you own the people, basically, because generations are signed down to paying off the debt. And this system has been here for thousands upon thousands of years. And people don't realize that thousands of years ago, it was terribly sophisticated, just as it is today. There really is nothing new under the sun, as they say. So, and even by the use of war, the bankers had all of the ancient countries fighting each other, and then they would bring in their system and give the funding to create standing armies once they had their puppet master in control, their king or whoever they put there, and then they'd go and invade another country that was not using their system, and then they'd force that system upon them and bring in the same thing. So this has been going on forever. And when we look at the Muslim countries today, the countries who don't allow usury and often don't have a central bank, the US is simply finishing off the job so that the whole world will be under the same system.
Boy,
of centralized
yeah.
banking, centralized government, all connected to an international global government.
And Omar Khayyam
mm-hmm.
wrote about it.
Yeah, I put that in there too, just to let people see that there are old writings.
That was 11th century.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you remember that?
Yes, oh yeah.
Well, say it to our listeners.
Well, Omar Khayyam went through the...
What you wrote that he wrote.
Mm-hmm.
What, out of senseless nothing...
Yet to provoke a conscious something to resent the yoke. And then
of unpermitted pleasure under pain
yeah.
of everlasting penalties if broke.
Yeah.
What, from his helpless creature be repaid... Pure gold for what he lent us, dross allayed.
Mm-hmm.
Sue for a debt we never did contract and cannot answer. Oh, the sorry trade.
Yeah, because once they had their gold in circulation, they then withdrew it into the banks they set up and gave cheap alloyed coinage out in lieu of it to represent it. And then they would lend you back when you went for a loan. They'd lend you this alloyed. He called it dross. Dross
wow.
is what's left over from coal,
yes.
garbage.
Alan, let's pick this up on the other side of this break.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, this is fascinating. Folks,
mm-hmm.
we'll be right back right after this break. And if you don't have a pen and paper, it would be good to get one. And we'll give you Alan's address after you get mine on this commercial break. We'll be right back.
Going on? Stay tuned to FirstAmendmentRadio.com to find out first, and on satellite at Galaxy 13, Channel 16, Audio 7.70.
Now listen to me. The Bible says, render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's. I want you to know that a corporation is Caesar.
Government takeover of the church. This DVD is the most powerful tool we have for waking up those asleep in the pews. The scripture calls for his people to come out of her. The corporate church is the apostate church, the whore that rides the beast. Get this DVD for a donation of $25 from FirstAmendmentRadio.com. Make copies and give them away to your corporate church friends and loved ones. The truth will make them free. They will watch the DVD, Government Takeover of the Church. Order online today at FirstAmendmentRadio.com or call 559-781-3773. Who will tell them if not you?
Roll away the dawn.
You have been listening to Jackie Petrou's Sweet Liberty program on the First Amendment Radio Network. This broadcast is also archived and audio streamed on the internet at FirstAmendmentRadio.com. Sweet Liberty is a fully listener-sponsored program. Your donations to support these broadcasts are a necessity. Send your check or blank money order to Jackie Petrou, P.O. Box 190, Millerton, P.A. 16936. Again, send your check or blank money order to Jackie Petrou, P.O. Box 190, Millerton, P.A. 16936. Be sure to visit the SweetLiberty.org website. Thank you for your continued support. And stay tuned to FirstAmendmentRadio.com.
Okay, if you still have your pen in hand, let us give you Alan's address in case you haven't written it down. If you're interested in getting the books that he's written, Alan suggests if you don't have one, get that one first. There are three of them, and we're talking about the third one, Cutting Through. And all I can think of is cutting through the BS when I see that title. They're $25 each. And when you do order, send either cash or an international postal money order. You can get it at your post office, because a U.S. postal money order won't work, nor will a personal check, okay? And Alan's address is Alan, A-L-A-N, Watt, W-A-T-T, site, S-I-T-E, site 41, box 4, site 41, box 4, Astaire. That's like Fred Astaire with an E, E-S-T-A-I-R-E, Ontario. And the postal code is P as in Peter, 3, P3, E as in Elizabeth, 4, P3, E4, N as in Nora, 1. So that is P3, E4, N1, Canada. And be sure to put your full name and return address on it, folks, otherwise they won't deliver it. Those are new mail requirements in Canada. Can't put Uncle Soba somebody or JP something. It
Morgan.
Has, huh?
Morgan.
No, JP, that's me. Okay, so that's once again Alan Watt, site 41, box 4, Astaire, Ontario, P3E4N1, Canada. And this is fascinating, Alan. And I noticed that under these, and I'm glad you did that, underneath those two verses, you took a couple paragraphs to explain what Omar Khayyam was writing about.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you want to go ahead and finish explaining that?
Yes, well, what he was saying there was what they'd already been doing, and it was recorded that they'd done the same thing around 1800 BC when they really started bringing their gold in big time by trade into countries. And this is before they coined the money. They waded out and they brought the merchants with them, so they were all related, the bankers and the merchants, with their ships. And so it was easier for them when they invented coinage around 800 BC, because then they opened up banks where people could deposit their gold and silver. There was more silver actually than gold in use at the time, and they were told that they would get facsimiles in exchange for their gold from the bank. They would get either clay ones with the stamp on it with a number of the currency, or, and they found thousands of jars that were sealed with wax, because if moisture got to them, you lost all your money.
Wow.
And they also gave out the alloys, the cheap alloys of copper mixed with other things in lieu of the gold. And in Sparta, for instance, when the king realized there was a con game going on, he demanded, and he went with his guards to the bank that actually was set up from the Middle East.
And this was in Persia.
Uh-huh. Persia and Spartans as well, they both did the same thing. And they went into the temples. See, the temples were used as the banks. In fact, often the first funding of usury was to build the temple, which doubled as a bank. And when the kings went in to find where the gold was, there was nothing there, because the bankers, once they had given out the facsimiles, the cheap alloys, had moved the gold somewhere else for a loan to pull the same stunt on another country. So this has been going on forever, the same game, you see. And when Omar Khayyam wrote about it, it was the same deal. They issued him a statement that he now had X amount of money.
It was a loan, a paper loan.
But when he got his first bill into him, he had to pay it back in real gold. You see? So that was the con game that was going on. Technically, they'd given them the cheap facsimiles of worthless coinage, which was accepted at the time as long as people did accept it. But he had to pay the interest and the payment in real gold to the bankers. So this is quite a fascinating thing. Today it's no different. The international bankers simply write a check out to the treasuries, which print up the money. But the countries that get permission to print up the money have to pay back the bankers in real gold, silver, or real goods, which is a sweetheart deal, you know. So this has been going on for thousands and thousands of years. And yet banking even today is a mysterious body, and we're told that it's just too complicated for us to understand.
Well, of course it is, because they make it so complicated.
Yeah, and it's really very simple. It's a scam from the beginning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that is exactly, at least it appears from the little we get
mm-hmm.
of the history of what Jesus was exposing.
Yes, because it was no different than other countries. He went to the main temple there, and the bankers were doing their usury there, as they had all over the ancient world, because they always sat in the porch of the churches all over the world and did their deals and exchanged money openly, because again it was so clever, because in every, doesn't matter what religion you belong to, you could not give donations within the church except in your own coinage. So when you went in from another area or a different country, you had to exchange what you had for their coin, and of course they would charge an awful lot more in a transaction. It was international money trading that was going on, and Jesus of course exposed it in his day and was quite open about it. Then he came up against the Pharisees, who were part of the whole deal obviously, and you know, I think anybody would get crucified if you cut to the heart of the matter, and he certainly did, you know. Now all the rest of it that was tacked on to control the people was fairly typical. They'd used heroes in past times and killed them, and then used those very people who spoke truth to then control the people's minds.
Were
like,
they still
turn the other cheek?
Were they
but
still?
If you turn the other cheek, I know who's going to win.
Yeah, right. But that's what they say he said.
And he's a guy who gets crucified, killed by the government of his day, and yet later on in Paul's writings they have obey your government because it's put there by God.
Yeah.
a total contradiction of the life of the man they supposedly followed. You know?
Yes.
So, that by those very words, that means that why are they complaining about Adolf Hitler? He was a elected part of the government. Why do they complain about Napoleon or Lenin? And in other words, any government is put there by God. So obey it, you see. So,
yeah,
no, these
and
are
you
all
know what they in. You know what they use there?
Uh-huh.
That saying that Jesus supposedly said,
uh-huh,
and maybe did, render unto Caesar what is Caesar's.
Yeah, uh-huh.
And render unto to God what is God's.
Oh, yeah, they'll use that.
So that's what they use,
uh-huh,
to justify,
mm-hmm,
that you're supposed to obey your government.
Yeah, regardless of how tyrannical it is.
And don't you love it?
But if Jesus had obeyed his and kept quiet and did what they said, don't speak out anymore and ask for forgiveness, he'd have been alive, you see.
Yeah, and don't you love it that that Pharisee Paul,
mm-hmm,
was sainted by the church?
Yeah.
They call him Saint Paul.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
They won't use the word Saul. I guess that's too Jewish sounding.
It's not really. Again, it's esoteric because there's more meanings to Saul.
Well, say it then.
Well, if you take the Latin version, Saul is the sun.
Okay.
Know? So it's back
so what
to
is the sun
religion again.
When they always refer to the sun, El, the sun,
mm-hmm,
on the sun.
Yeah.
The Hebrew, and what was the on?
Oh, well, the on is the phallic reproductive power of the sun. In other words, the life energy that it gives
and
creation.
And so what did that mean, his name, the sun?
Well, when you'll find that in all the mystery religions, including some present-day Christian sects, that when you are initiated into that sect, you are given a new name.
Okay, but what does the word sun mean to them?
Well, even in the mystery religion, passes the power of the father who is initiated into his own offspring, the sun. So you have S-U-N and S-O-N, and they both mean the same thing.
And
that's
what
why
they
both sound the
what
same.
Do they mean, what do they mean to them, Alan? The sun, S-U-N and S-O-N.
It means that you are the son of an Illuminati.
Ah.
And even in ancient Egypt, now we're told about all the languages and how they confuse things with changing languages. In ancient Egypt, a man was also called S, and they have a little dot where the vowel would go, N. So it was son. Sometimes they spell it, in modern time days, they'll spell it S-E-N. So the sun in the sky technically was called the sun, the same word as we use today. And his offspring was also a sun, no different than a man's offspring.
So the sun in the sky,
yep,
was the son of God?
It's all allegory. They didn't believe it was really the sun, you know, a god. It was allegory for a potent power. Yes. And even we even use the same word for a male erection. It's called, you know what it's called. The hard.
Oh,
you know.
Okay.
Uh-huh. And that's where that comes from. Because that's what they called also the obelisks in Egypt. That was the on, the erect phallus of the person on earth who had been deified as a god.
Oh, yeah.
He'd gone through the degrees and now he deserved his own on.
Oh,
and they put that into the English language, and of course, most people will think, well, that's coincidence, but.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Nothing's coincidence. Same thing as calling our children kids, Alan.
Exactly, yeah.
And it goes way beyond just a baby goat.
Oh, yeah.
When you see the goat of Mendes,
mm-hmm,
as their international, is it? Universal,
mm-hmm, yeah,
sign of Satan. The goat,
yes,
of Mendes.
And even Lenin talked about the new technique or science of neologisms, new word creation.
Neology.
Where they would literally dehumanize as they split up families and then parents to children so that the state could indoctrinate the children, he said we will use different terms for the children and dehumanize them in adults' eyes.
Yeah,
and
well, kids is a good one.
Yeah.
Kids is a good one. We were called kids,
uh-huh.
and it was done lovingly.
Uh-huh.
I called my girls kids.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, at first it was brought to my attention that a kid is a baby goat,
uh-huh.
and that's when I quit calling my grandchildren kids.
Mm-hmm.
However, when I saw that picture of the goat of Mendes, that evil, putrid-looking thing with women's breasts and a man's erected phallus.
Yeah, the hermaphrodite.
The hermaphrodite with the goat's head.
Yep.
And I thought, and they said this is the universal representation of Satan. And
yeah.
I thought, my God,
mm-hmm.
we're not just calling our children baby goats.
Yeah.
We're calling them spawn of Satan.
Mm-hmm.
And, anybody who knows that and continues to say kids about their children,
uh-huh.
I think there's something wrong.
Well, we know there's a lot wrong.
Oh, well, it doesn't mean anything. Yes, mm-hmm. it does mean something.
Yeah. But you've said yourself about people who use the fluoride in toothpaste who know better, and they understand what you mean when you tell them about it, but they go ahead and buy the same stuff anyway.
Yeah, oh, I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
They pay for their poison.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, there are people, no matter what you present to them, will carry on because they believe. See, their inoculation of indoctrination is taken with them, and they truly believe that the media tells them everything that they would need to know. And if the media doesn't tell them, they won't believe you.
You know, the thing is,
mm-hmm.
the whole doggone language is made up so that we speak their stuff.
We do.
And there are times when I think, okay, how are we going to talk
mm-hmm.
if the only language we know is the language that they gave us?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you went through the alphabet one time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the different symbols
yeah.
of the different letters and what they mean. And
mm-hmm.
the school bus, you know, it's yellow and black.
Yeah.
It's carrying the little worker bees in it.
That's right. Yeah.
The little future worker bees.
And they have spelling bees at school.
And they have spelling bees, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then I found that prayer, tripped over it, looking for something in a Maryland newspaper online one day.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a minister's sermon about how we should emulate the bees.
Yes, uh-huh.
You remember that, Alan?
That, well, in Christian theology, even in Roman Catholic theology from the beginning, which doesn't surprise me, they also used the symbol of the beehive as the pharaohs had before them, as the perfect society with the royalty at the top, the queen, and the drones, meaning the priests round about her, who decided what the rest would be to eat. Which would turn them. They didn't get royal jelly. They got the lower grade, which turned them into worker bees. So they've always looked upon the beehive. Even the Minoans, who were that's where the bankers lived in the Aegean Sea at one point on the islands there, and they called themselves Minoans at that time. They have dug up these pottery replicas of the beehive. It was a very sacred symbol there for them. Because that was them creating their order wherever they went.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, and you know what that brings to mind? Pat Schroeder was a U.S. Congresswoman from Colorado.
Uh-huh.
And I heard her, I even got it on tape on C-SPAN one day.
Mm-hmm.
They were talking about, I can't remember what it was, but something about the children. And she said, our children shouldn't even be brought into this.
Mm-hmm.
They are our future of tomorrow. They are our greatest natural resource. More so than gas, than oil. In other words, she said, I wish I could remember it closer to the word. That's basically the way she said it.
Uh-huh.
They are the future tax base of this country.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
They are our greatest natural resource.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I wonder if that woman I wonder if these people crawl out from under rocks, Alan.
Yeah.
You know, that they can say something like that.
I know. And yet, you know, the high economists that advise on the system are well aware that that's exactly how it is. It's a legalistic system which has everyone born into the system as a potential laborer and tax producer with X amount of years to put so much work into the tax base. And that's why only this system is allowed to exist, because it enables a bunch of elitists at the top who do very little and they do no real work and could not survive in any system outside this particular one they have created, because they're useless at anything else. But it allows them to live high on the hog, higher than anyone else, and live a life of luxury. Technically, they don't even own anything. They have the use during their lifetime of incredible government-owned buildings across the, not just the one country, but across the planet. And that goes right back to Plato in the Republic. He said we'd create this system. He says, why own something and then have to hire guards to watch your property and then pay for the maintenance and upkeep? He says, why not have ourselves as the government, he said, and the public will then maintain it all, pay for it, build it, supply it with guards for us. And that's the system we live in today.
Ha. Huh.
Yeah.
Well, now, this sounds pretty... it's like we would have to quit almost breathing not to be in their system.
They have made it so...
Well, I understand that, but, you know, I want to say this, mm-hmm. because this... We've gotten to a point, sometimes we do this mm-hmm. in our conversations, where I get to a point where I'm like, okay, you can't talk without using their language that they gave us.
Yeah.
And you can't, I mean, we quote, live with the exchange of this fictitious paper.
Yeah.
And it brings me to a point where it's like, what is the use? And then I remember, and I really believe this is true, what you said, when we were talking about the Federal Reserve one day,
yeah.
and the gold-backed, people keep wanting to go back to gold
yeah.
as the standard,
mm-hmm.
Not really understanding, because I didn't, they control the gold.
Always did?
Yes. And so it doesn't matter whether it's paper or what it is, mm-hmm. when they have control of it, they can make a shortage of it any doggone time they want.
Yeah.
But one of the things you said when I, in my huffiness, because you were ticking me off,
yeah.
because everything I said, you said, no, that isn't going to work. You cannot get out of their system by using their system.
That's right. Yeah.
And then I said, okay, fine, what's your solution?
Mm-hmm.
And you said, if enough people get it,
yeah.
this system will collapse of itself.
Yeah, I mean, it's a complete fiction.
It is a fiction.
Yeah.
But people have to really get it that it's a fiction.
That's right.
It's just like they're selling the air today, Alan.
I know.
Well, you know, with those pollution credits.
Yep, uh-huh.
Jesus. You know, they crush a car is worth $700 in pollution credits,
mm-hmm.
and they sell the actual, some large corporation mm-hmm. pays the $700 to the government
uh-huh.
to pay the person whose car they crushed.
I know.
And that corporation gets to spew out $700 worth of tons of crud into the air. Now
yeah.
they are selling it across international borders.
Yes, and you can pay in advance now.
They're selling the air.
Uh-huh. Well, King James, you know, the great King James of the Bible, when he wasn't chasing the page boys, and that's a fact, if anybody wants to study up on it.
He was a real pervert.
Yeah, he taxed the light and the air.
The light? Oh, windows.
Yeah, the window. And if you opened the window, then you were also... You
know, no, I think what it was however many windows you had in your house.
Yes,
to let the light in.
But also, when you had them open, and the tax man came round, that you were taxed extra because that window could open to let air in. That was a bit of
a
luxury.
Oh, that's the air.
So, yeah, they taxed everything you could imagine. And a lot we can't imagine, I suppose, is still to come. But they've tried all this before. And as I say, that one priest, scholar actually, young guy, who left his records in Sumer, he said, I look to the left, to the horizons, he says, horizon to horizon, and all I see is government buildings. He says, they tax our food, he says, they tax the fishermen as we bring in our fish. Before they could land the fish, they had to pay taxes on it. The fish were sold, but the tax when they were sold at the market. He said, when we go to bury our relatives and leave offerings on the grave, he says the government men comes and demand tax and payment for the offerings, or else to take the offerings. That's death duties. Nothing has changed, you know. This is a slavery system, more sophisticated than it's ever been before. And that's what Charles Galton Darwin said. He said, we're in the 1950s, he said, we are creating a new, more sophisticated form of slavery. And very few would be able to figure it out. Once you're conditioned into it, it's hard to figure it out.
I don't know if we have time here, but I would like to quote from page 59 of the book. Where this is where you were telling about the Royal Institute of, and et cetera, and the CFR. And you said, the following extract is taken from an international meeting from June 8th to 10th, 1931, in Copenhagen.
Yeah.
Speaker is Professor Arnold Toynbee of Oxford, Director of Studies for the Royal Institute of International Affairs, London. Oh, shoot. He was also master of... Never mind, I can't do it. We're out of time. Folks, I would recommend that you get Alan's books. I mean, I think it really can help to pull us out of the lies that we have been born into and that we just don't want to let go of. And then maybe when you see some of this stuff, it'll begin... For those of you who really want the truth, this is a doggone good start. Alan, thanks again for being with us tonight. And thank you for the work you've done here.
Thank you.
Yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, have a lovely 4 days off. And we will see you back on Monday. And remember, this broadcast is sponsored by you. We need your help, really, if we're going to stand.
Roll away.
You have been listening to Jackie Petrou's Sweet Liberty program on the First Amendment Radio Network. This broadcast is also archived and audio streamed on the internet at firstamendmentradio.com. Sweet Liberty is a fully listener-sponsored program. Your donations to support these broadcasts are a necessity. Send your check or blank money order to Jackie Petrou, P.O. Box 190, Millerton, P.A., 16936. Again, send your check or blank money order to Jackie Petrou, P.O. Box 190, Millerton, P.A. 16936. Be sure to visit the sweetliberty.org website. Thank you for your continued support. And stay tuned to firstamendmentradio.com.
The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests, and not necessarily those of the First Amendment Radio Network or its affiliated radio stations.
Now listen to me. The Bible says, render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's. I want you to know.